welcome back to a rather glorious episode of Conversations with Nova Reid.
I am delighted to let you know this special episode is being sponsored, and our sponsor is a tech company called The Hopper. And in brief, what The Hopper do is invest in tech startups, particularly startups founded by women and other people in marginalized groups. And Hopper was founded by Grace Hopper, who's a programmer and computer scientist and inventor. And The Hopper have been so supportive to me personally with my business. And the reason why they had me at Hello in 2020 was because they used taglines. They call their founder a badass, and their tagline stood out to me about that they always question the status quo. And the support that they have given me personally it came at such an extraordinarily difficult time for me, a time that was difficult personally, but where my business was seeing growth and where I needed support and I couldn't find people who were socially conscious and anti-racist and understanding of the work I do, and the intricate needs of what I have because of who I am and my identity, and the fact that we're operating in a system that really is geared towards whiteness in particular, let me name it, white men. And so to have found a company that supports, so their primary function is to fund new businesses, but they also offer business development and mentoring, branding, marketing, and a whole lot of other stuff. Some of the things they helped me with was, in fact, they were responsible for helping me find my rather sexy new course platform for becoming anti-racist and ensuring that it was going to meet my needs and guiding me along the way, as well as many other things. And they've just been a joy because they bring the humanity into business and into working with the person that's behind it. And that just feels very rare to me. So I wanted to share a little bit more about some of the magic that they are doing. One of the things that stood out to me is they are launching a mentorship program in 2021 that is particularly for school leavers, so for young people who may want a career in tech but don't really know how to go about it, and just winded in opportunity and helping them see what could be possible. And they also have an empowerment program, which is really interesting to me, that particularly speaks to women in tech and people who are consistently underestimated and underrepresented. And it looks at business mentoring, it looks at training, it looks at support, it looks at being able to market and research and gain insight from people who already have expertise that may be able to add value to your business. And there was a stat that was shared that last year saw the most amount of money being invested in businesses than ever before on a global scale. And it was also the year that it saw the least amount of money being invested in women and the least amount of money being invested in people in other marginalized identities. And of course, those that intersect. So we have a lot of work to do. It sounds like The Hopper are doing some things to try and bridge that gap. So do check them out. You'll be able to find them and more about their magic and find out more about when their 12-month mentorship program starts for young people and their empowerment program for women and people in marginalized groups starts as well. Keep an eye out on their Instagram, thehopper.tech, and the website using the same details, thehopper.tech. Enjoy. And one of the things I love about them is they're not professing to be perfect. They are on the journey, and that is the best place to be. I am humbled and honoured to have had the opportunity to interview a British civil rights activist and someone known fondly as one of the grandmothers of black feminism in the UK, somebody who I had the pleasure of being taught by and have learned a huge amount from, incredible Stella Dadsey. She's a published author and historian,
human being, activist, and everything in between. She's a founding member of an organization called OWAD, the Organization of Women of African and Asian Descent, a kind of umbrella group for black women that emerged in the late 1970s as part of the British civil rights movement to address growing race inequality and how black women and other women of color were compounded by that. And she's been in this game for 40 years. She is somebody who has provided the groundwork for people like me to be able to do the work that I do now, and has paved the way for people like me to be able to do the work that I do now. So I feel quite emotional. I'm very lucky to have stolen an hour of her time to share with you today. Her book, A Kick in the Belly, and The Heart of the Race, Black Women's Lives in Britain. The latter won a 1985 Martin Luther King Award for Literature and was republished by Verso in 2018 as a feminist classic. You are in for a treat. So much civil rights and anti-racism activism has been led by incredible black women, and it is an honour to bring this episode and to make you aware of formidable activists like Stella Dadsey today. Over to the episode. I would love for you to let me know what you think. Connect with me over at Nova Read Official on Instagram. Enjoy. Welcome back to Conversations with Nova Read, and I am absolutely ecstatic to be able to bring with you incredible human being and activist who has paved the way for so many women and humans like me, Stella Dadsey. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
I like to kick off this conversation by asking you who you are beyond your role. So who is Stella Dadsey beyond her roles?
How long have you got?
Long.
That's actually quite an interesting question, isn't it? I suppose I'm a mother to a son. He's 40 now. He's an artist. I am a partner to a lifelong friend and soulmate. So we're growing old together. In terms of my professional life, I'm a teacher. I've always been in education. I did actually get thrown out of school and vowed never to step foot in a school again, but I ended up being drawn to education and have been involved one way or another in schooling and working with teachers and educators and pupils and students ever since. I'm a writer. I'm a historian. And I guess some people say I'm an artist, although I'm not sure I always own that. But I do paint. It's a go-to place. I guess that's me in a nutshell.
How do you think others describe you?
Again, an interesting question. I'm not on Twitter, so I try not to take too much notice of what others say in that regard. I mean, I do believe in self-criticism, and I take note when people are critical. But I think, you know, if you want some of the sort of broad brush descriptions I've heard recently, someone described me the other day as one of the grandmothers of black feminism.
Ooh.
I found gratifying on the one hand and slightly uncomfortable on the other.
Mm. Can you share more about the discomfort?
Yeah, just because it was a movement, you know, and there were many, many women involved. Because I've written books, my name comes to the fore a lot, but I've always felt nervous about any one person sort of taking centre stage or trying to pretend that they, or trying to suggest that they are, you know, more important than anyone else.
Yeah,
Yes, it's a nice accolade and appreciated, but as I say, I'm worried about all those people who might turn around and say, "Ooh, gee."
And there's that other caution of people placing us on these pedestals and then taking any moment to knock us down, I guess, as well.
Yeah, there's that. I think there is a real culture of celebrity, isn't there? People want their sheroes to put on pedestals. And I guess the older you get, the more important that becomes to some extent. I think all of us want to feel that we've left something behind. But as I say, you know, I came out of a movement that was committed to collectivism and where we, I think, consciously tried to avoid that kind of iconism. It's an interesting term.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm going to take you back a little bit, if it's okay. I know from reading your bio, but for listeners, where did you grow up and can you share a little bit more about what that was like?
Well, I was born in London. My mother was in the WRAF during the war, and I suspect she met my father through those circuits. I mean, he was in the RAF. He was, in fact, the first trained Ghanaian pilot.
Wow.
And he stayed here or came back here after the war to study law. I don't think I want to go into too much detail into their relationship. I've always had a kind of question mark in my head as to how on earth they actually got it together, because they are real chalk and cheese.
Yeah.
My mum being a sort of English Rose type, whose father was in colonial administration, believe it or not, and my dad being a fiery Nkrumahist who worked with Nkrumah to fight for Ghanaian independence and was actually thrown out of King's College for his activism. So I've always had that kind of question mark, and I've always thought whoever wrote that story, I would have to do what Terry McMillan did in Disappearing Acts, where she told the same story but from two completely different perspectives, because it's the only way you'd really do justice to their different versions. But anyway, I grew up, my childhood was controversial. My father believed that my mum wasn't really capable of raising me, and he probably, there was some truth in that, and he took me to Wales as a small child and left me with a foster mother who was also fostering my other siblings, whom he'd had through various relationships. But my mum, to give her a due, she fought and she got me back. She took him to court and she got me back. So I spent my early childhood aware that I had brothers and sisters and a dad somewhere, but not actually in touch with them. And growing up in actually quite extreme poverty, really. My mum, I said she was a sort of English Rose, but she fell from grace as soon as produced this black child. And, you know, single parents, single mothers in the 50s weren't really respected much. So she had a hard time, and I ended up in and out of care as a small child and ending up really in a boarding school at the age of 8. But still, you know, going home to my mother in the holidays. And then I met my father, family friend, went behind my mum's back, actually, and reintroduced me to my father as a young girl of 11 or 12. And I was swept into a very different world, which was the world of a young African diplomat who was stationed in Paris, although he'd been in Romania prior to that. And very much swept into a very Afrocentric world.
Yes.
Where there was a kind of pride and self-assurance that was quite at variance with my mum's timidity and her sense of shame.
Yes.
So I kind of had to juggle that through my childhood, and I guess it made me the person I am.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that. Thank you so much for sharing. I appreciate that. So you've segued right into my next question. When did you consciously become an activist? Or was it something that you just did?
I think it was something I just did, to be honest with you. I said earlier I was thrown out of school, but I did end up doing my A-levels and doing a degree at King's College. Because I'd had no one to help me fill in my UCA form, I filled in it wrong and I ended up majoring in German, which hadn't been my plan. But part of the course involved spending time in Germany, either at university or working there. And I'm talking Germany in the early 70s, which was a real eye-opener in terms of the kind of in-your-face racism that
was
prevalent and remains prevalent in pockets at the time. So I found myself very, very isolated and very much at sea, really, quite a naive young woman without much of a sense of what was going on in the world. Although I think at that time I'd already begun to read books that were coming out of the civil rights movement and novels by Richard Wright and things like that. So I was beginning to develop a kind of sense of self, but it was very much living in Germany among an African refugee community, predominantly Eritreans at the time, that gave me a very quick crash course into the way colonialism works, the nature of some of the wars that were going on the African continent, and also a sense of what racism meant in my own life in a way that probably hadn't been articulated by my mother. My mother used to say, "They're just ignorant, ignore them," which wasn't really that helpful.
Of course.
So coming back to England after that time away, I was very keen to link up with people who had similar interests and passions, and I began working with some, there were young men at the time, Ricky Cambridge, Cecil Gutsmore, Colin Prescott, on a journal called The Black Liberator, which was an intellectual journal aimed at people here, and also for another journal called The African Red Family, which was aimed at cadres fighting for liberation in Africa. And I guess that was the beginning of my activism, although I don't think I used the word. I just saw myself being drawn towards issues and concerns that were increasingly issues and concerns for my whole generation, really, because the context was civil rights, the context was anti-colonial struggles in Africa and anti-apartheid struggle in particular, in South Africa, and of course a growing civil rights movement in this country as people began to speak out against police brutality and educational disadvantage and all the other things that were going on here.
Yeah, thank you. And I guess that leads me into you being one of the founders of the Organization of Women of African and Asian Descent in the height of civil rights movement in the UK. I guess, was there fallout from centering women, black women, Asian women, and not staying together as a collective?
Yeah, I can still remember us being accused of divisiveness, splitting the struggle. And certainly there was a sense in many mixed organisations committed to black liberation, that you know, the primary struggle was the struggle against racism, and that everything else should take second place. So when women started to raise those concerns that particularly affected them or their children, there certainly was a degree of fallout from people who either didn't get it or who accused us of imitating white women, because the other context, of course, was the emergent white
feminism,
women's movement. And I say white women's movement because it was predominantly white, not exclusively. I mean, there were individual black women who were attracted to those meetings and discussions, but it was predominantly white, very, very middle class. And, you know, misogyny came into the mix, you know. Anybody who associated with a kind of feminist argument was often dismissed as a lesbian or someone who wanted to be white. There are all kinds of subtle ways in which people tried to undermine our project. But I don't remember taking much notice of it, really. It was kind of noise in the background. What we were taking notice of, and this was true at our very first meeting where we came together to discuss what an organisation of women might look like, was the voices of women who came up from the African continent, women who were in ZANU, women who were associated with the EPLF in Eritrea, and the Ethiopian women's movement as well, whose name I've forgotten. But, you know, the women from that background who just said, listen, you know, you need to be autonomous. If you allow yourself to be subsumed within a predominantly male organisation or to cater within it, you will always find yourself kowtowing to that louder voice. And that's the voice we listen to, which is how OAD came to be formed.
Wow. And what were some of the things that OAD campaigned that you are most proud of?
I think there's a number of things that I'm proud of. I certainly think that commitment to African and Asian unity was really important, not just because it was of its time. You know, we're talking about first, second generation immigrants from whatever background who were struggling to find a sense of place and a sense of place in this society. But certainly the way we openly declared that unity and tried to support each other's struggles, even though they didn't necessarily coincide, we recognised that they came from the same stable and that there was strength in unity. Yeah. That was really important. I think the other thing that I'm particularly proud of would be the fact that we always had an eye on our countries of origin.
Nice.
The thing that makes OAD, I don't know about unique, but certainly noteworthy, is that we had a very clear anti-imperialist, anti-colonial perspective on what was happening here. We made the links, we saw how it connected up. And that meant that we stayed grounded in a particular kind of politics.
Wow.
What else? I think the issues that OAD took up, which included, you know, our relationship with the police, relationship with schools and teachers, our relationship with health services and social services, all of those issues came to the fore. So it's difficult really to pull anyone out. But because I was a teacher all my life, I'm always minded that some of the campaigns that women involved in OAD were pursuing in their own communities, because don't forget OAD was an umbrella organisation for groups that were out there. I think they were really powerful. They empowered parents, they empowered pupils, and you can still hear the kind of echoes of some of those struggles in the discourse today, you know, the Black Lives Matter discussions around decolonizing the curriculum.
Yeah.
Nothing new, you know, talking about that in the early 70s. And I'm not sure whether that's something to be pleased about or not, that we're still talking about it all these years later. But I think it is important that people recognize that these are not new discussions.
Yes.
And that there is a proud heritage to be reminded of.
Yeah. And I don't think, you know, the fact that these conversations are not new, I think is a sign of, as a human society, we are unhealthily repeating patterns of behaviour. And I think that, I believe that's down to so many not having knowledge, not having basic understanding of the foundation of who we are and where we've come from, and, you know, education again, this gaps in history. So the information is there, but we have to seek it and to know what it is that we're looking for. And I think that that's the challenge.
I agree. I think I look sometimes at the willingness of people to buy into certain conspiracy theories or to just repeat or retweet or, you know, sound bites of information without actually fact-checking stuff. And it does seem to me that that's an indictment of our education system, that we haven't taught enough people to be inquisitive, analytical, to find out for themselves, to feel confident in their own ability to self-educate. I'm sure that's true of all generations. I know what strikes me about my own generation, because we were children of the civil rights movement and all the other things I've mentioned, there was a real thirst for that knowledge. And people did. They went out, they sought the books. We didn't have access to the same kind of social media now. So in a way, I kind of feel that younger people have less of an excuse, because it's out there at the touch of a button. But yes, there is a need for people to know their history and to understand who they are and where they came from.
Yeah. Okay, that leads me nicely into your work as a historian, really. One of the things that so I discovered Stella through a series on African resistance in black women, really, and with Black History Walks. And Stella was a guest lecturer, and I was just mesmerised by, because you weren't always sharing new information, but it was delivered in a way that it felt new, or, you know, it was new. It was history in a way that was so human and accessible. That's just what's coming to mind now, but. Yeah, I think what am I trying to say is that you make history inspiring, Stella. And that certainly wasn't my experience at school. I mean, I'm not sure that's a great benchmark, but it's all I have to go on. And I mean school, I mean degree level as well. You make it human, inspiring, and it was just, I'm getting goosebumps again now. So are you aware of that? Have you heard that before in some way?
Not quite so beautifully put. Thank you. I think people do often ask me about how I feel about accessibility. And for me, I don't know whether it's just because I'm a teacher, because I was always more interested in those kids who couldn't access learning than the ones who could. But I've always felt a very strong commitment to making history and knowledge more generally accessible. There's no point in doing it otherwise, is there?
I mean, no.
And I've said in previous interviews that I feel a degree of frustration with academia, because it is such a closed shop, such an ivory tower. And I do know that that's changing, and that there are more and more real people going into these organisations and trying to free them up from decades, centuries of exclusivity.
Yeah.
But to me, yeah, it's absolutely vital to me that anything I write is available and accessible to people who may not have had a university education. Is that because I know my community? No, I mean, many of us are university educated. I think it's more about just recognizing that the messages may, as you say, be already out there, but they're not necessarily getting through. So in terms of a kick in the belly, you know, one of the issues that I agonized with when I was beginning to write it was how to write this story in a way that isn't just totally depressing
and
undermining, because it is often presented as a story of victimhood, a story of people who had no agency, no power over their own lives. And what was the point of writing a book like that? Now, the only way to really address that question was to say, okay, what aspect of that story is empowering?
Yeah.
What aspect of that story is uplifting? And to me, that's the story of resistance. It's the story of women who found ways to fight back.
Yeah, I've been, I've butchered your book, Stella. It's got underlines, folded pages, and it's something that I will keep going back to. But it was hearing about. I mean, there's two questions in here. Firstly, as a historian, how do you research and write about the trauma, the historical, intergenerational, so much layers of trauma, really? How do you write holding all of that and look after yourself? So there's that. And then the other thing is, it's probably more of a comment, but just reframing how African enslaved women were, the roles were breeders or labourers, and how some of those women would use, well, would stop breeding via whatever method, including abortion, but as a means of resistance. Now, that was something I had never heard of before, and was really, it made a lot of sense and joined a lot of dots for me in terms of this ownership over black women's bodies in particular. But the reframe around resistance was really powerful. So, yeah, I'll go back to the first question. How do you hold all of this stuff when you're researching and writing, when we're so connected to it in some way?
I started my research into this field in the mid-80s, so I've had a long time to kind of absorb it and to process the traumatic aspects of that story. And I should say absolutely up front that I'm not the only historian who's come up with these conclusions, who's come to these conclusions. You know, as I mentioned right at the beginning of my book, you know, it stands on the shoulders of some very Afrocentric historians who began to delve into the story of women and enslaved people and began to highlight some of these aspects of their experience, either through their examination of the data or of the documentation that's been left to us and various other sources. So how do I process and hold all of that? I think in the same way as we all process and hold the many other horrors that exist around the world in our contemporary lives that affect innocent children and women like us and people who aren't that far removed from us in terms of our migratory journey, with a degree of outrage and anger, but also with a degree of hope, I think, because we survived. We continue to survive. We continue to tell the story. And I'm not saying that survival is enough. Mm. You know, I want us not just to survive, but to thrive. And I think that's the added element, isn't it? That in looking at that history and saying, okay, it was a horror story. There's no getting around that. It was a horror story. But look, despite that horror story, there were women who just said, no, this ain't happening. And who seized the small pockets of agency that were available to them, whether it was, you know, how they opened the blinds, how they followed instructions, if they were people who worked in the house, a capacity to wipe whole families out if they had knowledge of obeah and poisons.
Mm. Can you share more about that?
But also, just to finish the point, the little agency they had over their own wombs.
Yeah.
You know, that was absolutely vital. And any woman knows, and it's part of what feeds into misogyny, I believe, that the one thing men cannot control is your fertility.
Yeah.
You know, they might make you pregnant and they might claim fatherhood or deny it, whatever. But that decision, whether to pursue the pregnancy, whether to try to terminate it, whether to raise a child, whether to give that child away, all of those issues are very personal.
Yeah.
And they became very political.
Mm.
When you think about the context of slavery, where it only survived if black women continued to give birth to new
life.
So I think that's a long-winded answer to your first question. I've forgotten the second.
I think the second one was more of a question, but it was just an important point. I think it'd be nice to share, if you don't mind, just about how black women used obeah, or knowledge of produce, and how to use that to poison people. Are there some stories you wouldn't mind sharing about that?
Well, you know, part of the problem with this particular history is that, you know, we're quite often required to filter what we know about them through a white male gaze.
Yes.
You know, it's the white men who left the diaries and the plantation records and the parliamentary debates, all that stuff that, you know, arose around the discussion of what was happening demographically to the enslaved population. So I sometimes refer to it as listening to the music behind the words. But what is absolutely clear is that those women who came naked on the ships and crossed the Atlantic came with knowledge of who they were. They came with knowledge of the environment from which they'd come.
Mm.
And they came with a commitment as women to passing that knowledge on to future generations. And despite the fact that every attempt was made to suppress that knowledge, to discourage people from turning to those cultural references, whether it was drumming or singing or speaking in their own languages, or indeed obeah, which was a source of severe paranoia amongst the very outnumbered white planter class.
Mm.
Despite that effort to squash it, it was somehow enabled to survive and in some cases to thrive. If you look at some of the Maroon communities, not just in Jamaica, but that one comes to mind because it had a very Fantia Khan kind of basis to it, with Nanny and Kudjo and her Fanti brothers leading that particular group. What you see is, even to this day, language survivals, references to I came across one quite recently. Apparently, the Maroons still use the term Abruni, which comes straight out of my father's language and refers impolitely to white people, but more subtly to anyone who is westernized.
Mm.
So you'll hear of people of American or British heritage going back to Ghana to find their roots, and feeling quite offended when people turn around and call them a Bruni. You know, because that is a reference to the fact that they're westernized, or what my auntie used to talk about is you Afropeans who eat with knife and fork.
Afropeans.
So, yeah, those cultural survivals are really fascinating to me. They really make me want to know more.
Mm. Because
what you see is a real evidence, don't you, of that German saying, the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world.
Wow, yeah.
You know, it was women who had some decision-making powers over whether or not to pursue a pregnancy. And, yes, of course, into this mix comes all the poor diet and the overwork and the, yes, prolapses and all the other horrors that made fertility hard in its own right. So I'm not saying that's the only explanation for the demographic decline, but what you see creeping into the debates that are held by the white men themselves are these references to black women who take abortions, who use yam,
yes,
which was powerful and which was often used as a poison. I wouldn't want to list the herbs. I'm not an expert.
No.
And I certainly wouldn't want people to try it at home. But it's absolutely clear that, you know, those wise old women, those sage women in our communities, despite every effort to suppress their knowledge and their sense of self, managed to sustain that and to pass it on.
It's incredible, the stories of resilience is extraordinary. I'm in the right, well, I've nearly finished, but writing The Good Ally, my book is out this year, and hearing about some of those stories for the first time and revisiting old ones, it's something that you touched upon earlier, that this work isn't just an individual's, it's collective. But I think what a kick in the belly did for me is it gave me, I mean, I'm very empathetic anyway. I take on a lot. I feel a lot. So it was not an easy read, not all of the time. But what it made me appreciate even more is just the what so many people in my lineage and beyond had to endure for me to be here today, for you to do the work that you're doing today, and for me to do what I'm doing today because of people like you. And so for me, that acknowledgement, that attribution is so important, because also what I discovered from your work, Stella, is that there's so few records. There's so much of black women's role in resistance appears to be erased.
Yeah, it has. It's really been airbrushed out of history, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And that's partly because of what happens to women and women's history generally. And that's partly because of racism. And it's partly because of, you know, the way academia works and what is considered to be worthy of study.
Mm.
I think, as I said, that's changing. And my hope is that the current and future generations will continue to dig deep, because actually I suspect a lot of the data that's out there hasn't yet been unearthed. I'm doing a piece of work at the moment for Greenwich Maritime Museum, who are looking at ways to humanise their exhibition. Particularly with reference to the transatlantic slave trade. And one of the things that is very, very clear to me from just beginning to flirt with some of the maritime records and some of the digital archives that they have, is that there's still a lot of scope. For example, in the kick of the belly, there is reference to onboard rebellion. And there's also reference to the fact that a lot of ships' captains underplayed the extent of rebellion, because it reflected badly on them and their capacity to discipline their crew and what they regarded as their cargo, but also because it had an impact on insurance and prices and so on. But there are references to onboard rebellion, and there's references to women who, because they weren't shackled, were able to roam the decks, to spot where the weaponry was stored, to check what time the watch changed, all those things that were absolutely vital to those shackled men who lay below decks, unable effectively to do anything.
Yes.
You know, there's even a woman, what was her name? I'm not sure she was named, actually. The guy was named, and that's another interesting aspect, isn't it?
Ooh.
That there was this onboard rebellion, and we know about it because the captain cowered below decks and was able to subsequently write an account of what happened. And this is often the case that, you know, the story comes down to us through the mouths of somebody else. But what one of these references referred to was a woman who managed to steal a hammer and to free her male fellow captives, who then came up on deck, and some were frightened by the sound of the gunshots of those crew who were able to fire on them, but she was one of those who didn't retreat. She came forward, and when they were subsequently captured and tortured in the most horrendous ways, we are given the name of the man who was tortured and murdered, but not the name of the woman, although her torture is described. So I suppose I'm rambling a bit, but I think what I'm trying to say is that we ain't done yet.
Yes.
We ain't done with this story yet. And the more we look, the more we reinterpret these data through our own eyes, through our own gaze, the more we see things that perhaps others haven't seen. For example, one of the things that Lucille Maturin-Mair, who's a Jamaican historian, pointed out in her research, was that when you look at the comparative prices of males and females through the period of slavery, what you see is a very, very tiny differential. And that suggests very clearly that women's labour was seen as important as that of the men.
Yes.
And then when you look at the data of who was doing the hardest work, who was in the field gangs, who was in the first gangs and the second gang and the third gang, what you begin to see is a very, very different picture to the one that the white planters wanted to convey.
Yes.
And of course, as women, we know that European women were seen as delicate and frail. As, you know, they daren't even bend over and open a drawer if they were pregnant. And yet black women were having to crouch down in fields and give birth and then carry on working.
Yeah.
So to justify that, you get a white male gaze that kind of de-feminizes us.
Yeah.
And which almost suggests that this was normal and natural.
Yes.
For black women.
Yeah.
Now, that's what we've been handed down through the centuries, that version. And it's only now that we're having, relatively recently, I should say, in the last 30, 40 years, that you began to have women, black women and men, look at this stuff with a different sensibility, that you begin to see, actually, what I see here is something different.
Yeah.
You know, so as I say, we ain't done with this history yet. And my real hope is that a kick in the belly will be something that inspires women to look at different aspects of the history that's told there and delve a bit deeper.
Absolutely. That's what it's done for me, without a doubt. And just to add on to that, those stories through the white male lens, when they don't dehumanize black women, what it does is undermine patriarchy. Completely undermines it if we're not capable of working, but yet black women are doing more work than black men. It just it undermines all of it, all of it.
Yeah, and it's an interesting debate because, you know, you get into discussions about strength versus stamina, you know, and mortality rates. And there's some really interesting medical historians who've been looking at that, people like Richard Sheridan and Michael Creighton. Interesting stuff because, you know, you can, if you begin to really look at the data, see that women's mortality improves, particularly creolized women, women who were born into enslavement rather than brought over on the ships. And you also see evidence that not only did men die younger, but, you know, they were equally exposed to torture and abuse.
Yeah.
So you have to begin to wonder why on certain plantations, you know, something like 50%, 70%, sometimes higher percentages of women ended up working, doing the hardest work. Some people say it's because men had access to a wider range of roles on the plantation. Some people say it's because women had greater stamina and that, you know, those who owned them began to get a sense of that and realise they were a better investment long term. There's all kinds of theories. And, you know, I'm a historian. I've always believed that, who was it who said, can't remember who said it now, but history is a child's box of letters from which we can make any word we choose.
Ooh.
Wow. So what that is acknowledging, I think, is the sense that, you know, none of us were there.
Yeah.
All we do, like a detective, I think I refer in A King in the Belly to the fact that I see history as like a detective story, because all you're given is a set of clues,
yes,
and some evidence, and it's down to you to piece those clues and that evidence together to come up with a version of what happened.
Yeah.
Now, what's happened to us over the years, coming back to your point about black women being airbrushed out of history, is that, you know, that evidence has been completely ignored or not seen as relevant enough.
Yes.
To help us actually determine who committed the murder.
Yeah.
But now we're beginning to revisit that evidence and see that, you know, there are different ways of looking at it.
Yeah. Love that. Thank you. A couple more questions. I'm going to segue into education. Let me share a short story first, and I'd love to hear your response. I was listening into a session that was happening during Black History Month about how we start to decolonize curriculums, start teaching a wider range of all of our history, and, you know, strategically center on Black history as well, and what that might look like in secondary schools, I think it was. And there was a number of ideas put forward, which were great. And there were some questions afterwards by a white male teacher who said, I live in a majority white area and I don't have any black children in my class. What is the benefit? I mean, I have my own thoughts, but I would love to just hear your response to that limiting rhetoric that is present in some schools at the moment.
My response is, you know, that French phrase, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. And the more things change, the more things stay the same.
Yeah.
It is sad for a teacher to have that view. And if you wanted to be really devious, then you could turn it on its head, couldn't you, and say, well, what's the point of black people learning white history?
Absolutely.
You know, there's no logic to that. We know this pandemic, if nothing else, has focused everybody's attention on the fact that we're living in a global village. And the more we know and understand each other, the better chance we have of getting along.
Yeah.
Now, that's one possible answer. Another response that I would have to that intervention is, I suppose what I've been saying for some time now, that I think that whole concept of black history is a little bit past its sell-by. And I say that not because I don't think it hasn't served its purpose and been of its time, but because that notion of Black history is used as a get-out clause.
Yes.
It's seen as something separate. It's seen as something that has nothing to do with the body politic and with mainstream real history, if you like. Now, our history didn't drop out of another planet, you know. It's intricately bound up with the history of British imperial expansion, of Britain as a maritime nation. All the wars that were fought were territorial to some extent, so it's bound up with that. And there are also a lot of Black people and a lot of blood, Black blood, sweat and tears that actually enabled that story to develop in the way that it did. So to actually dismiss that whole tranche of history and say, what's the point of teaching it? It's not really relevant. It just says more about that person than probably he would want us to know.
Yeah.
You know? And I just feel sorry for the pupils of teachers like that. Now, I said to you earlier, and I've worked in education all my life, and when I decided I was not going to work for the man anymore and launched out on my own, thinking that I could do a day or two a week of training and then get on with my real job, which was writing and creating art, and then got a real rude awakening when I realised actually to do that, it's a full-time job and everything else comes plays second place. But when I decided to do that, I found myself working with teachers in schools and lecturers in college and management teams. And, you know, I worked with literally everybody from, you know, education policymakers at the United Nations, right down, and I say down because in terms of the hierarchy it was, to kids on the street, you know, in detached youth work projects. So everything in between. And I've seen a lot of denial and a lot of ignorance in that journey. So nothing surprises me. It really, really doesn't. But you'd think in the context of this revived interest that's come out of Black Lives Matter and just the debates that have been going on in education around race and racism, I mean, even Black Lives Matter, it's only reviving discussions that we were having when Scarman did his report, when McPherson did his report.
Yeah.
Look at the milestones and see, you know, everybody getting all excited about this discussion or feeling the need to at least acknowledge that it's going on, and then it all goes quiet again.
Yeah.
So let's hope this isn't going to happen this time. Let's hope we keep it on the agenda and have some very persuasive arguments where we encounter teachers who really genuinely think that this has nothing to do with them.
Yeah.
It's ludicrous.
Yeah.
What, we don't teach boys about women because they're boys?
What's the
benefit? You know the logic of that is just not worth.
It's flawed. And I also acknowledge that there are some teachers who have not been equipped in their training and feel ill-equipped to, well, their own anxiety and their own fear and discomfort about talking about race as we know it gets in the way of them being able to have meaningful dialogue about periods of enslavement or even Black Lives Matter. So to the teachers who I know who are listening to this, because I have some in my network who are really doing great work, what tip would you have to empower them to use their self-agency to make change in that environment and to better serve the students?
You know, there's no easy answer to that. And because I've worked in schools and been a teacher myself, I know that, you know, there's a lot of politics that go on in schools that can detract from the good work that carries on in the classroom.
Yeah.
But I've worked with teachers who've had that nervousness around addressing issues of race for much of my life. And I do know there are ways to empower them and to make them feel confident. There's a tension, isn't there, between appearing to know all the answers
Yes.
and drawing on the resource that's in your classroom.
Yeah.
But I do think that we should see our pupils not as empty jugs whose heads have to be filled, but as a collective resource. And that, you know, by pooling those resources, and I including that, the resources of parents and community, you can come up with a really vibrant, informed curriculum that doesn't put all the onus on you, the teacher, to have all the answers or to say everything the right way. I produced a resource years ago called Trial and Error, which was an attempt to give teachers the tools with which to address these issues in the classroom. And basically, you know, if I strip the methodology down to a few sentences, it required teachers to pose different positions, right? For example, you know, the police say this about black people, but black people say this about the police, you know. And then to invite pupils to go out and find out as much about that as possible by interviewing people in their families, going to local police stations, going to the library, going online, whatever, coming back with their evidence and then forming a kind of jury. And the task of the jury was to, in recognition of the fact that adults had made a complete cock up of it, come up with their own suggestions about how to address this particular issue.
Yeah.
Now, what that enabled teachers to do was, A, empower students to find out for themselves, B, to be able to say, I don't know, Johnny. I don't have an answer to that. What do you think?
Yes.
Or what does your mum think? Or what do people you know who are adults in your world think? That, to me, is about bringing a bit of humility to the table.
Yeah.
It also gets around the problem that I hear a lot of black students refer to, which is, you know, I'm paying for this course, miss, but the teacher keeps asking me.
Oh, yeah.
You know, which is another issue that teachers have to overcome. In terms of language, because there's a specific nervousness, isn't there, around language. I've always started from the position that language is dynamic.
Mm.
That language is something that we constantly strive to find a new way of expressing.
Yes.
Yeah? There's never going to be exactly the right word. If you think about the sort of debates that are going on at the moment about political black and BAME.
Yeah.
That morass of
noise
that goes on around it, and I find myself smiling a bit. It's like, because when people ask me to describe myself, I always say it depends who's asking. You know, it depends who's asking, because the answer will be determined by the context. In absolutely. Some contexts, it's absolutely important for me people to know that I'm of Anglo-Ghanaian heritage. In other contexts, it's simply enough for them to know that I'm a black woman and that's how I see myself.
Yeah.
You know, in other contexts, it will be important to acknowledge mixed heritage and all that brings into the table. You know, language, labels, all of those things are dynamic, and all we can do is try to work through some of the contradictions that arise when we use certain terms, recognise that language is generational.
Mm.
And if somebody calls me coloured, it's not the crime of the century. What it is a reflection of their own generational ignorance, that they can still refer to me in such a Eurocentric way. Coloured in relation to whom?
Yeah.
You know, I used to have this T-shirt and it said something like, when you're angry, you're red. No, when you're hot, you're red. When you're cold, you're blue. When you're sick, you're green, and you've got the cheek to call me coloured.
Mm.
Yeah? Mm. So it's a Eurocentric term, and it's understanding the Eurocentrism of the term rather than just, you know, coming with this kind of cancel culture that, you know, you use the wrong term, so I'm not speaking to you. It's that kind of discussion that I think teachers need to be engaged in.
Absolutely.
You know? I can remember back in the day, you know, lots of sort of anxious discussions about whether it was all right to say bar, bar, black sheep with primary school children. To me, that's just a diversion.
Yeah,
sorry, whether you use bar, bar, black sheep is so irrelevant and it's such a sidetrack.
Yeah.
What matters is whether you treat that child in your classroom with equal value.
Absolutely.
And if you come across terminology that makes some people feel uncomfortable because they're referring to a colour, then you're open enough to sit down with those children or with fellow colleagues and say, let's discuss what it is about this term that makes people uncomfortable.
Absolutely.
How can we explain that? You know, I've always felt, you get me on a soapbox now. You have to shut me up now. I've always had this real discomfort against people who want to, who suggest that we shouldn't study Shakespeare because he used the N-word.
Oh, come on.
Come on. You know, the educational project is to say, this is the language he used in the whatever century it was. Isn't it interesting how language has developed?
Exactly.
Why do you think people don't want to use those terms anymore? What do you think has changed? Mm. That's education.
Yeah.
It's not saying we don't use that term because it's offensive and end of discussion. That doesn't take anybody anywhere.
No, it's reductive. And I think, yeah, it's just having some honesty with it and naming it. Right? Okay, that's really uncomfortable for me. And why? And then getting some critical thinking going around it. I find the cancel culture is so reductive, and it stops us from actually doing meaningful work. And perhaps perhaps I need to do a solo episode on that one. But yeah, I hear you.
It's reductive. It stifles debate.
It does.
And it actually doesn't take us forward. You know, I said this to somebody the other day, and I'll say it again. You know, we're all here because of something someone did before we came.
Yes.
We've all got a level of awareness or consciousness or language because someone took trouble to teach us.
Yeah.
And the teacher in me is absolutely opposed to the kind of mentality that stifles learning.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stifles inquisitive minds. You know, if a little white kid in my class uses language inappropriately, I don't want him to feel so ashamed that he becomes defensive and is thrown back into a camp of racists.
Yeah.
I want him to understand that that's okay, you know, that it's all right to ask if you don't know. You know, that's a couch. I'm overstating my case, but...
No, you're not. And I think there's a fine line sometimes between debating somebody's reality versus debate on facts and information as we know it. And I think that to me is the fine line. Encouraging people to be curious versus holding a boundary and saying, actually, you've just crossed a boundary and this is why. And I think there's learning from both of those things.
Yeah, and we need to be aware of false consciousness as well. That was my final point, because you know, you hear people speak with such authority, don't you?
Yeah.
And we're not allowed to say black bag in our department because our black colleagues might be offended.
Give me strength.
I just want to roll on the floor.
Give me strength.
You know, again, it's a deflection.
Yeah.
It's a deflection from the real issues. The real issues are whether you are erecting barriers that destroy my life chances.
Yeah.
Or reduce my life chances. Yeah. Whether, you know, your attitude to me or your assumptions about me are correct or not. And I think sometimes those debates about black bags and little blah-blah black sheep, they're just like...
It's white noise, Stella, I like to call it.
It takes me back to the discussion about Land of Hope and Glory. You know, suddenly the discussion about police brutality... became a discussion about what we're allowed to sing at the proms.
Oh, Jesus.
You know, and I'm not sure that the media does it deliberately. I don't subscribe to the Trump message that, you know, it's all a bunch of lies. I absolutely don't believe that. But I think somehow we do. We allow ourselves to get diverted
from the actual issue at hand and resolving it. Absolutely. And I think... Yeah, and I think that takes back to where you almost started, is that the conversations that we're having now are not new, and I think part of that is because all of these deflections and distractions take us away from the work. So leads me into a last question for you, Stella. I feel sad I have to let you go. I could talk to you for hours. but just a message of how do we, you know, whether it's for black women, people who are involved in activism in some way, how do we cling on to hope when you kind of, again, you're straddling the outrage and the frustration sometimes, but also recognizing how important hope is. How, any words of wisdom on how we cling on to hope?
No, but I can only tell you what I do when I'm at a low ebb. And I really want to acknowledge that we're living through times that make it very difficult to feel hopeful.
Yeah.
You know, I'm having to grapple with that myself. I've got a grandson. I've got a son. My partner's got children as well and grandchildren. And sometimes I look at the future as I perceive it and I think, wow.
Yeah. You know?
But I think being a historian helps. I think the fact that I know that we survived some of the darkest episodes in human history.
Mm.
I mean, you couldn't come up with anything worse than 400 years of slavery, really, yeah. Could you? Even the death camps only last 6 years. And I'm not saying, you know, probably longer than 6 years, actually, let me get that right. But I'm not saying there's any hierarchy of oppression here. But,
yeah.
You know, we really, really have come through some dreadful periods in time, and yet here we are still able to sing, still able to dance, still able to create beautiful art, still able to nurture our children,
yeah.
Still able to speak and be heard, you know, all of those things. And I think my hope comes from knowing my own people in a way, you know, and not just my own people, because I think it's a human trait that goes beyond race, that yeah. Amazing power of human beings to overcome, to be creative, to be intelligent, to find answers to the problems, to find ways to overcome the obstacles. We get a lot of focus on the negative stuff that's going on around the world at the moment, and positive stuff doesn't maybe make such an impact in terms of headlines, but it's out there. It's actually in the air we breathe, and I think sometimes it's incumbent on us to delve, to tease out those stories and to remind ourselves that bad as things might seem, people have been through worse and they've come out fighting,
yeah,
laughing, singing, and able to, you know, claim their own humanity.
Thank you so much, Stella. It's a beautiful way to end. I would encourage you listeners to grab a copy of Stella's book, A Kick in the Belly, which is available via Verso Books. An absolute honour to have shared a little over an hour of you. Thank you, Stella, for all you have done and all you do.
One of the most humbling experiences I have had on this podcast, and you have just been given an absolute masterclass for free on Black history. So if you're somebody who would like to express gratitude, do that in a way that feels meaningful to you, but do honour the wisdom that has been shared to you by Stella Dadsey, and grab a copy of her book, A Kick in the Belly, Women, Slavery and Resistance, and also another book that she co-wrote with British Black Panther Beverly Bryan and Suzanne Scaife, Heart of the Race, Black Women's Lives in Britain, Masterclass, Free History Lesson. You're welcome. You know what to do. If this episode resonates with you, please hop on over to your podcast host and leave us a 5-star review. Thank you so much for sharing space and tuning in today. Take care of you.